Uzun is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. The views of our guest, and, well, our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, who's a health journalist who writes extensively, and you may often hear him on the radio talking about various drugs, not on our program, but all across America. But tonight we're going to be talking about, well, we're going to be talking about vaccinations. We're going to be talking about a doctor named Dr. David Graham, who works for the Federal Drug Administration. And we actually had reproduced in one of our newsletters, perhaps a year or so ago, Dr. David Graham's testimony before the Senate on Vioxx, where he pointed out that the Merck company knew that Vioxx was going to kill an awful lot of people. They knew it would significantly increase the incidence of heart disease and stroke, and they concealed that. And they concealed that from the public and from the doctors, and until eventually they were required to pull it off the market. And now there's some new evidence coming out. So, Bill, tell us what the latest information is about Dr. Graham and the Vioxx scandal.
Well, actually, Senator Chuck Grassley, he's a Republican from Iowa, really has his hands around the neck of the Food and Drug Administration. And, boy, are they squirming. He's accusing the agency of actively working with the drug firm Merck to discredit a whistleblower by working with on the Vioxx scandal. Now, as you recall, Dr. David Graham, an employee of the FDA, was the whistleblower who alerted the public to all the concerns and safety over the anti-inflammatory drug Vioxx. And, of course, he had to leave the country to do that. It was reported in the British Medical Journal also, from overseas, so they wouldn't accept it here in any publication. So he got the world's attention, but it says here now that Senator Chuck Grassley has evidence that the FDA officials met with Merck for the specific purpose of discrediting Dr. Graham, one of their own employees. And as Senator Grassley says, it's no secret that Dr. Graham was and is a critic of the Food and Drug Administration. However, that does not mean the FDA should scheme with drug sponsors to discredit its own employees. Moreover, the FDA may disagree with the characterizations made by Dr. Graham, but that does not absolve the FDA of its duty to maintain a clear, bright line between the regulated and the regulator. And so now they apparently have evidence that our own agency, our own federal agency that's entrusted with protecting us, tried to collude with a drug company to discredit their own whistleblower. So if this doesn't blow up the FDA, I don't know why this agency continues to exist. They keep the same employees there. They keep the same people in heads should have rolled. And, of course, we're all at risk for unsafe drugs that are on the market.
And, of course, you know, I think it's interesting that Merck has won several cases. But the cases they're winning are somebody, you know, who's 250 pounds, who's diabetic, who's been taking the drug for a couple of months. In fact, I suspect they're even getting attorneys to take some of the cases that they know they can win, you know, to throw the cases to try to confuse the issue. But they've got 10,000 cases out there of people who have suffered heart attacks and strokes. And some of these people have a very legitimate claim against Merck. And they're playing games and they're conspiring with people in the government to discredit the man who exposed the fact that they knew they were going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. Well, Bill, go ahead, pick up the story there.
Well, certainly we are concerned, and of course, as we go on with the story here, the continued issue keeps arising. This report this week talking about the drug makers routinely fail to file status reports, that is, the safety studies. Now, they're going after the dietary supplement companies. They're going to make them report on any serious adverse reactions. It turns out the way they worded it, anything that you have to go to a doctor for and question when taking a vitamin pill, why that will be called a serious adverse reaction. We're chasing the adverse reactions with vitamin pills. We can't find any at the poison control centers in the last 8 years except for ephedra, the weight loss herb. And yet, they're chasing these down while the FDA is remiss in getting the drug companies to give us the safety data, which is a follow-up once drugs are on the market. We think they're safe once we're using them, but they're not proven to be perfectly safe or safe in comparison to other drugs. So we don't know all the data until they're on the market and they're used by thousands of more people. Then you can see more side effects occur. And, of course, when millions of people take a drug like the statin drugs for cholesterol, then you can really, even a small percentage of side effects, 1%, would certainly harm thousands of people. So you have to look for these kinds of things. At any rate, we're under the false impression that the drugs are proven safe and the dietary supplements, of course, don't have to undergo that kind of a review, and that now we're going to require adverse reaction reporting on the dietary supplements. Well, this continues to be an issue because the FDA really hasn't followed up and required, well, the drug companies are required to do this, but they haven't made them do it, let's put it that way, so that the actual follow-up on all this has been lagging. So how many drugs are involved? Well, the Center for Science in the Public Interest says there's quite a few. Ralph Nader's organization, Public Citizen, said there's quite a few hundred. So how many drugs you might be using that are still not proven safe, we don't know. It appears to be the mass of them, the great bulk of them, continue to be a big problem. So, we have all these issues going on. And the FDA, we still don't see people being fired. We still see all this kind of a thing going on, and heads aren't rolling. So apparently Senator Grassley's trying to do something. There's too many other senators battling him.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bill Sidey. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Bill Sardi. We're talking about the FDA. I would just mention that we do carry a book called The Truth About the Drug Companies, What You Should Know About the Drug Companies by Dr. Marshall Angel, former the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine on the staff at Harvard. And when she tried to get the truth out about the drug companies and their sweetheart deal with the Federal Drug Administration, they came after her with tong and fang, and they did everything to the point where I've tried to contact her a number of times, never been able to get through to her or get her onto our programs. But Dr. Marshall Angel, I certainly was well aware of the fact that there is a sweetheart situation between the drug companies and the Federal Drug Administration, and many, many people are being seriously harmed by that.
Well, certainly we do have a real problem because, as we stated before, the drug companies, the pharmaceutical stocks on Wall Street, are a great pride to our country. They have about a 20% profit margin, net profit margin pre-tax, which is among the highest. And so they have a lot of investors, billions of dollars of sales. And, of course, the FDA is friendly with them. And, of course, it gets worse than this because a lot of pension plans and so on have stocks bought in these companies, and so you could bring them down. And one thing that's bringing them down is the patents that they have on their drugs are expiring. We're going to generics. They're trying to extend their patents in phony ways with the Food and Drug Administration working with them and the various congressmen and so on. This is driving up the cost of medicine and as we know it, and yet we just don't see any. It's Congress that's corrupt and paid off in this kind of thing, and so we don't see the kind of oversight that we really need here for this kind of thing. And so we complain about the high cost of medicines and everything, and it's Congress who really won't push for the generics, and really, even when the generics come and the other ones are off patent, we've seen the pharmaceutical companies just supposedly run out of the generic or pay off the companies that are making the generics. They'll make an over-the-counter version that you don't need prescription for and then run out of it and tell you you have to buy the prescription one that's a patented because they made a little different version of it. So they're playing all kinds of games.
Well, I think the biggest thing that really disturbed me was the fact that when Zocar came off of a patent, why, I think it was Merck, isn't it Merck Production? But,
yeah.
But they actually paid the competitors who were making a generic not to market it. Now, that would me to be a conspiracy and restrain of trade, but you don't have to worry. They're not going to go after the big companies. They're going to go after Martha Stewart because she got a tip on a stock, but they're not going to go after Merck Company that was paying off the competitors not to market their generic brands in Zocar. Now, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, the Federal Trade Commission should have stepped in, as obviously somebody's holding them back.
Sure there is. And, Chris, there's so much corruption in our government because we are a nation that has lost its way. We've lost our moral foundation. And when that happens, of course, everything begins to fall apart, and you really can't trust the drug companies. The book we mentioned earlier, The Truth About the Drug Companies by Dr. Marsha Angell, we do carry it. As I said, on the staff at Harvard, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, certainly the single most prestigious publication we have in America, and of course what they did to her is amazing, the harassment she got. And what was her crime? She wanted the American people to know about the truth.
Well, certainly, this comes out. Our problem is at the level of patients, the public. They're taking medicines now, and they can't quite equate with, my doctor hasn't told me any of them are unsafe, and so therefore I keep taking them, and the doctors have been remiss here.
But lots of time the doctors really don't know. I mean, Burr covered up the truth about Vioxx, and they told their detail people specifically not to tell the doctors. And if the doctor asked, you know, what about the relationship between heart disease and Vioxx, where the detail people were to tell the doctor to write to Merck. And then the doctor, how many of them are going to write to the drug companies? But if they did, then Merck would say, oh, well, you write to the FDA. And then they'd write to the FDA, and the FDA didn't know about a lot of the studies that Merck had that was withholding them. So, I mean, the doctors were, at least as far as the Vioxx was concerned, were intentionally deceived.
Well, there's no question about this. We think some of the higher-ups at the AMA or some of these other groups, some of the universities certainly know about all this. And they're the ones that are remiss. And finally, I was going to lose all faith in the doctors when recently the AMA did say, petition with the FDA to stop advertising on television and elsewhere of any newly approved drug, because this is the first thing they're doing, because we really don't have all the safety data at that point. And that's what Public Citizen has been saying, the Ralph Ortnader organization. Don't use any new drugs because we just don't know whether they're really safe yet.
Okay, if you're going to use a new drug, remember they're experimenting on you. And what they really want to know is what happens when a large number of people take them. Of course, if there are adverse effects, the drug company may know about it, but they're not going to report it to the FDA because then they'd have to pull the drug and they'd lose all that money. And the crass indifference to human suffering and death and disability is really amazing. And then, of course, these drug companies have billions of dollars to fight you if you want to bring a lawsuit against them.
Well, they certainly do. The biggest area we see, we're talking about drugs so far, but, of course, we just have a great concern over this vaccine issue. Not only are they seem to be promoting a worthless idea of building and developing a vaccine against the bird flu, which is really against birds. I mean, but they want to give it to all of us. So it's an imaginary disease or a threatened disease or a cry wolf disease. And they want to vaccinate the whole world against this. And then apparently every year, influenza viruses are so rapidly mutating that you really can't develop a vaccine adequately. And it will alter just slightly by the time you've made the vaccine. The one in circulation will, of course, pose problems because it's a little different strain. And so, therefore, we're just questioning whether they can even do this. It seems like most of the flu shots that people get every year have seemed to be worthless when they look back on these data now. They keep using this phony story, 36,000 people die every year and all this, but they're lumping in cases of pneumonia and so on. And as Barbara Lowe Fisher of the National Vaccine Information Center goes through some of the data with this, it's data that we originally created from Knowledge of Health, and she's gotten a hold of it and started to use it. And when we get down to it, that 36,000 deaths really gets down to about 325 that are actually confirmed to be caused by the influenza virus. So, I mean, they're trying to scare us to roll up our sleeves and do something that could only have side effects. That's all that it could be. And
don't forget, of course, they've intentionally left the thimerosal in the influenza vaccine, which they want to give to women in the first trimester of pregnancy. You know, why would you want to give it women in the first trimester of pregnancy? Influenza is not a problem in women. A friend of mine did a study, certainly I think it was Kaiser statistics. I mean, they had, I think, 2 women out of 10,000 admitted for influenza, you know, in a period of a year. This is a non-problem. And yet they're insisting on vaccinating them, knowing full well this is the time when they could do the most harm to the brain of the developing child inter utero. Why would you do something that like that and risk the brain, the mind of a child?
Problems we have is they apparently have some hot lots, that is, production lots of these vaccines that they try and attenuate, or that is, kill off the virus. And then you're taking a dead virus, and then you put it in, and your system thinks it's alive and develops the antibodies. So, but apparently, some of the efforts to kill it off, you might get a hot lot where there's still some virus that's viable, and therefore you're getting a little bit of the disease and infection. And that's exactly what we keep saying. You've told us many times on the air, Dr. Stan, people get a flu shot and come down with the flu.
Right.
So that's probably a hot lot. And our big question now is that they want to vaccinate the very, very young, 6 months of age, with the flu. But we're worried about side effects with that little group because they really don't have the ability to even make the antibodies.
And of course, the animal studies, what's really so interesting is animal studies are using thimerosal in quantities comparable, show that as far as the female animals, why they abort. But not only that, but their children and their children's children abort. I wonder if that is why Bill Gates, who is in favor of population control and wants to vaccinate all the children in the third world countries, and they still have all the mercury in those vaccines. They didn't take it out, third world countries. I wonder if there's any relationship between the fact that the animal studies show that if you give these children or animals mercury, why not only the children, the animals, will abort, but their children and their children's children. In other words, you do some sort of a genetic damage that goes from generation to generation, and America is going to be sure that all those children get their vaccines because we're so concerned about them. It's sort of like we're selling tobacco all throughout the world, and we're going to kill millions of people throughout the world by pushing tobacco. Where are our legislators saying you shouldn't be pushing tobacco and trying to convince the people in Asia certainly in Africa to start smoking? Because we know it's deadly. But have you heard any outcry here in America for the fact that we're going to kill millions of people with tobacco? And what are we going to do with those vaccinations we're going to give to all those children throughout the world where we've left the mercury, the thimerosal in those vaccines? We've taken it out here, the childhood vaccines in America, except for, of course, influenza. But we've left it in for the rest of the world. And I remember, of course, talking to a gentleman who went to Africa on a tour. He came to see the Minister of Health in the country. And the first thing the minister said was, why do you Americans want to kill our people? Why do you Americans want to kill our people? Well, Bill, pick up the story there.
Of course, we're facing the autumn and spring in front of us, the next two seasons, and of course that's the flu season somewhere in there, and they're warning us this is going to come. And it's kind of odd, we don't see any cases of the bird flu in the United States yet, though we see it here and there around the world. Maybe it's because we're well-nourished, maybe it's just because birds don't fly this way. It seems a little implausible, but at any rate, why we don't seem to have it here, as the SARS virus came and went and disappeared from China, and they thought it would circle the globe, and it went to Canada, and they said there was a big outbreak when there wasn't. And, of course, doctors here said they were seeing a few cases, but they were so minor as to hardly call it anything big because our own immune systems and so on took care of it. But what's interesting is the disparity in the headlines concerning a bird flu vaccine. Now, we see headlines, they cannot develop a bird flu vaccine. It'll take 10 years to do it, this kind of thing. And, of course, we have a medicine, Tamiflu, another one, memantine. And, of course, neither one really address saving lives or stopping the flu. They just shorten the duration of the flu, and they have to start on these drugs within 48 hours of the onset of the symptoms. So unlikely in a massive thing you'd be able to get this to everybody, but the federal government has brokered a deal with the vaccine, or excuse me, the drug manufacturers, to offer Tamiflu to each state, and then each state is to buy them and then have a giant supply. 13 states have been reluctant to buy much of anything, but many others have bought. And, of course, as we know, there's a political connection between Donald Rumsfeld of the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense, and Tamiflu. He was the president of Gilead Pharmaceuticals, which now licenses the Tamiflu to other companies. He still owns stock in that. And you see this massive effort to push things for him. Of course, we see Condoleezza Rice. She used to work for British Petroleum, and now we see the price of gasoline and oil go up. And, of course, we see the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, and all the contracts he gets for his former company. So it's just kind of feed the hand there. And nobody brings this up. I think the journalists are quite frankly, afraid of approaching these issues since there was anthrax letters sent to the news press in the United States after 9/11. And I think they're just frightened, actually, in this whole issue. But what's very interesting in this whole thing is that while we're saying we don't have a vaccine, so you might have to rely on Tamiflu, which has never been used to prove that it would stop mortality, only the symptoms, and all this billions of dollars of Tamiflu being purchased. But in the middle of this, on July the 10th, Russia said it expects to have a bird flu vaccine prepared by September and have 60 million doses. I'm stunned. They told us it was 10 years away, we'll have to use Tamiflu, and now in Russia, where the graft doesn't exist, in that sense, where they're not really trying to push Tamiflu, well, of course, they've come up with the vaccine apparently on their own. So they're going to have 60 million doses. Now, I'm just wondering why, well, if it's any good, I don't know that we could accept it, but why aren't we getting the bird flu vaccine from Russia?
No, well, you hang on there. We'll be back in just a minute. Maybe we can ask Mr. Rumsfeld. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is our good friend Bill Sardi, and we're talking about the non-existent bird flu epidemic that is probably, it's been around since 1959. Many people in China have antibodies to this bird flu. They tell us it's 50% fatal. They keep repeating that over and over again, 50% fatal. I mean, it's going to be this terrible, terrible epidemic, but as you analyze what's going on, we probably lost not more since 2003 when they started recording it, maybe 160 people throughout the entire world have died of this. And there have been a couple of very, very strange situations. There was a family of, I think, of 6 or 8 in Indonesia that they all died, and they were saying it had person-to-person transmission, but it seemed to be an entirely different virus. In other words, an entirely different type of virus, and it certainly wasn't one that certainly seemed to have come from the birds. We don't know where it came from. It wasn't in the birds locally there. So there are lots of strange unanswered questions. Haven't you felt that way, Bill, as we see this mass hysteria being created by the controlled media to make us all afraid of the imminent bird flu epidemic?
Well, we certainly have disparate stories, disparate news. I mean, one says you'll never develop the vaccine in 10 years. Russia then says it has it by September. One says it's just a bird, flu, which is exactly what it is. And then others say, of course, here's a headline, written headline story by a professor emeritus in microbiology and another associate professor in microbiology at Miami University in Oxford, England. And they're saying the headline of the story, bird flu carries worse threat than terrorists. And they go on to cite all this misinformation. I sent them an email with no response, as they go on to the same typical line that you're talking about here, the 50% mortality rate. Now, exactly what they're doing is, one, they can't confirm really genetically that these are real cases of bird flu. And, of course, the World Health Organization being called to task, can you prove that? Can you send us the genetic sequences? And they haven't done it. They said that it belongs to Indonesia where they're seeing these cases. And so they haven't been forthcoming in showing the world that these are really confirmed H5N1 avian flu cases. But of the people that have died, the number of people that have had this, 100, 200 people, and half of them died, they're only counting the people who get the most serious form of this flu. The ones who get mild forms in the upper respiratory tract develop antibodies. We know there are people in Russia, likely to be in the millions, who've already developed antibodies against this virus on a natural way because they're exposed to the close contact with birds and fowl there more than we are. So what happens here is that we already see that happening. The question is, where is this really going to go? Because they're already developing natural immunity, so is this really going to set this off? The ones that are dying, it got into the lower respiratory tract, and that's the only ones they're counting. So out of the 200 that got it in the lower respiratory tract, after many, many years, we think millions may have already been exposed to this. Otherwise, the H5N1 bird flu virus has been around, they admit, since the 1950s or 60s, so this isn't new. It hasn't mutated into this more lethal form that they say could be the same form that caused the 1918 Spanish flu. So it hasn't done that yet, but for some reason now we are to be worried about it. And, of course, the concern now is that would half the people who got infected die? No, because not half the people get this into their lower respiratory tract. Very few do. You only see in a number of years here only 200 and some people. Half of them did die. So they're rigging the data so that it looks like there's a high mortality rate. And when called to task, the researchers, I don't know why this goes on, but the world news media seems to be working in league with this whole thing to set the whole world up for a massive vaccination effort at some point. Now, one of the major drug companies is building a multi-$100 million vaccine plant just for flu vaccines in the United States. Do you think they're building that without the assurance from federal government that we're going to get everybody vaccinated and scare them into this?
And remember that Dr. Futenberg study that showed that if you take four or five of influenza vaccine shots over a five-year period between 60 and 65, 1,000% increase in the incidence of Alzheimer's disease 10 years down the line. If you'd like the reference to that, if you'd like the page from Dr. Futenberg's website, we'd be glad to send it to you. Call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Could that really be true? 1,000% increase in Alzheimer's disease? And it's increasing, but nobody knows why. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bill Soddy, and we're talking about the influenza vaccine. Of course, they're trying to scare everybody into taking influenza vaccine, and I'm 77. I've never taken an influenza vaccine. I've seen too many people get complications from it. I've seen so many people take the influenza shot and come down with influenza. And why do this? I mean, you may feel bad for a few days, but of course, if you can take lots of things that, you know, to prevent this, and go ahead, why don't you mention some of the things that you actually can really to do to build up your immune system, Bill? Would you want to talk about that?
Well, certainly you can, and just start with the basics, vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, and zinc. These are two trace minerals, two essential vitamins. And they do seem to do a lot. And if you're vaccinating your children, then certainly get a lot of vitamin C in those children around the time that they're going to be vaccinated, before and after. And Dr. Stan, you were asking me about vaccination and brain inflammation. And, of course, I think it was Dr. Fudenberg who was talking about this, because this is how you get into the Alzheimer's.
No, well, actually, Chris, Dr. Blaylock, as we have a great new DVD put up by Dr. Blaylock,
right,
we're going to make available. And he was talking, Dr. Russell's a personal friend. I've known him for over 25 years. And he points out that there are studies that show when, if you vaccinate a child, not necessarily for flu, but for anything, it produces an inflammatory response that mobilizes the immune system throughout the body, and you get inflammation in the body, but specifically the most sensitive organ is the brain. And so you begin to get inflammation in the brain because of the vaccination. And then of course, I mean, this can go on for a year. And just about the time you're getting over the inflammation in the brain, then you vaccinate them again and again and again. And have you run into this story at all?
Well, you have. And let me try and explain it so everybody understands it. It is very important, if you're getting your children vaccinated, not to allow them to vaccinate the child on a sick visit. That is, my child's sick, he looks like he's got the flu or something, I take him in, and then while he's there, he gets, oh, well, it's convenient, let's just shoot his arm with some sort of a vaccine. And the reason for this is, and I try to make this as clear as I can, the pre-existing virus or infection in the body may be serious enough to be weakening something called the blood-brain barrier. And once it is weakened, where things can get across, the brain is protected so that you won't get the kinds of toxins and things into the brain. But it may be weakened and broken down somewhat due to an ongoing infection. Now you
hold that thought for just a moment. Mel, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bill Seiley. We were talking about the complication that comes with many children. When they're vaccinated, they tend to get an inflammation in the brain. And this is something Dr. Blaylock has talked about. And large studies show, and of course, this is something the average doctor doesn't know, but Dr. Blaylock spends all of his time, like Bill does, studying the medical literature. And there are large studies that show that every time you vaccinate, either in a adult or a child, you tend to get inflammation in the brain, and then of course that inflammation persists because the brain is a very, very sensitive organ, and it's very, very sensitive to inflammation, and so it goes on. It may go on for 6 months or a year, and then just about the time the inflammation is beginning to subside, the inflammatory response that comes from the medicines that are used to mobilize the immune system to promote immunity against the disease, then it vaccinates them again. And so many of these children have a more or less chronically inflamed brain. And Bill was just going into the background of that. You want to pick up the story there, Bill?
Well, and as you see this, so I can kind of prove the evidence to you, here's a German study. It's Morbidity Mortality Weekly in German. We have a Morbidity Mortality Reports in the United States. And this report of April 2005 just simply documents 120 fatal brain complications from measles, not the measles vaccine, just measles. What I'm trying to point out to you is that the measles virus is able to weaken and attack the brain because it gets past the barrier. Now, let's say you have another virus or you have the measles or something, and now while you're there at the doctor's office, they give you another vaccine on top of this that's going to travel across that weakened barrier, and you have one of these hot lots where there's a real virus, it isn't totally attenuated, or that is a killed virus, and so you get even worse kind of situation. And recall now, your body is going to come to some sort of a defense here. and it's the massive making of antibodies. You could have such an over-immune response, you could create inflammation in the brain that would be quite damaging. And so this gets to be an issue. Here they're going through, this is the Journal of American Medical Association of December the 7th, 2005, and they're talking about neurologic adverse events associated with smallpox vaccination. And they vaccinated about 600,000 people. There were very few side effects, but significant enough. And what they're pointing out, neurologic events, adverse events, nerve, the brain. And, of course, 95 cases of headaches. That means there's some sort of inflammation going on the brain. And then there was dizziness and vertigo, and then serious adverse events, including meningitis, encephalitis, which is the swelling of the brain and the spinal cord, myelitis, Bell's palsy, the nerve on the face, seizures. There was one death, 8 seizures, and Guillain-Barré syndrome, where you have a progressive paresthesia of the body.
Paralysis.
And so this goes on, and they're going through these numbers. Now, they're small, but the point is it's showing you that it got to the brain in a significant number of people, a few hundred here. And what we're trying to say is at the time you go in, you're likely to be in the doctor's office, you're not feeling well, certainly your children are, and they don't have a fully developed immune system yet. They haven't developed enough antibodies against things, and so this could be a serious problem, and they may not even be able to mount a defense against the viruses that weren't killed in a hot lot of the vaccine, and therefore they can't develop the antibodies against it, and therefore it's going to run havoc on them. Children very young simply don't do this very well. So this is why we don't vaccinate newborns, because they're just in they have very little ability. They get all the immunity from mother's milk that has immune, anti-immune factors in it. And that's the vaccination that very young children get, is from mother. And, of course, so we realize how all this works. So we're trying to vaccinate youngsters as they're born, these newborn babies with HPV or, hepatitis virus and so on. So we're doing all these things in these young children and exposing their brain to inflammation. Now, so you all understand, if you just fall off a cliff and hit your head and you've got a concussion, you have massive inflammation in the dura mater, the watery material around your brain, for about a year. And every orthopedist and other brain doctors will tell you, please don't get your head hit in the next year, because it's going to take about a year for that inflammation to get down. You don't want to have another insult. So this is what you're doing. You're getting things into the area where, you know, that buffers the brain and these kind of things. And then you're allowing massive inflammation in there, and then this could lead to other serious kinds of problems. So certainly it occurs with any previous sickness that you may have, you're walking in. It could occur with a hot lot from a vaccine itself, and then, of course, this is why we say to take the vitamin C and so on. It seems to calm all this down, tries to get rid of the inflammation, and so on. So we like children to be on a lot of antioxidants at the time that they're getting these vaccines. So just wise advice. And many times the doctors want to do a series of 3 shots, as they're trying to do here with the human papillomavirus for cervical cancer for young girls, because it doesn't really take effect until they've done 3, and then you've developed up enough antibodies. Well, the problem with this, the first shot might have worked, but because they're not sure it worked, they have you do 2 more shots. Well, if you were smart enough to insist with the pediatrician, why don't you do what they call a titer, T-I-T-E-R, to see if there's enough antibodies. And if there are, you don't need the other 2 shots, but they're too lazy. So they order up the 3 shots, charge us $320 for this, when it may not have been needed. They're getting too lazy in what they're doing. We don't need more vaccination if a child doesn't need it. If you develop the antibodies on the first shot, then that's all we need. So they're just too lazy about this. And, of course, now you can imagine why we're so concerned when they have these combination vaccines where there's 3 and 4 diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, that's a whooping cough is the last one, or, you know, the MMWR, which, or excuse me, the measles, mumps, rubella, and so on. So these, you're putting so many chances of having a hot lot in here, so many, you're insulting the body to make antibodies for three or four viruses at one time. So you're really creating lots of inflammation, and if it gets through into the brain, remember, it might be a small number, but it might be your child. And when you're vaccinating millions, you can't afford to have 1% side effects.
But of course, Bill, we've seen since we started the vaccines a dramatic increase in juvenile diabetes. Since we started the vaccines, we've seen a dramatic increase of autoimmune disease in children and asthma in children and allergies in children. Since we began our vaccine programs, we've seen a dramatic increase in neurodevelopmental abnormalities, not only autism, but ADD and ADHD and learning disabilities. And the government says, well, we don't know where any of these things come from, but trust us. You can trust us. We'd never lie to you. We're sure that it's not coming from the vaccines. Where are the studies? They have none. Except that, well, there are some. If you go and look at the Amish children, they don't have the neurodevelopmental abnormalities. They don't have the autism. The Amish children, because they won't vaccinate their children, and their children aren't dying off, you know, complications of these diseases.
So we understand. Children get type 1 diabetes. It's when you're a child. Type 2 is the adult onset. So why are children having something attack their pancreas and then, of course, destroy so it can't make insulin, and now you have youth-onset diabetes? Well, there's something setting that off. We kind of are closer to understanding this now. We also have some children with youthful arthritis. And now, again, that will be a rheumatoid autoimmune type of arthritis. Well, now we see this Journal of Toxicology and Applied Pharmacology just published, and they're trying to show us that there's a connection between mercury and autoimmune disease. Remember, mercury is the preservative in the vaccines. And, of course, they're now showing that the mercury load is sufficient. If it would be given to a six-month-old to a two-year-old child, there would be sufficient enough, clearly within the dosage range, they're saying, of the observed accelerated effect of the development of autoimmune reactions in animals that we have seen. Now, they can't use humans, obviously, it would be unethical, but in these animal studies, they're showing that the equivalent of mercury would set off these kind of reactions, and they're autoimmune reactions, which the body against itself, the immune system can't be shut off. It's overreacting, and then, of course, you're into attacking some part of the body. Could be the joints. That's childhood arthritis. Could be the pancreas. Then you have childhood diabetes and so on. So these are pretty serious things. We see a rise in this. Remember, if all this is occurring in the brain, we've got autism to speak for here, so lots of other things. So, you know, this is just something we wonder whether we should be vaccinating. And I believe I did send you, Dr. Stan, a pamphlet from the National Vaccine Information Center. You can go to them, nvic.org. And they had a pamphlet there showing that my young two-year-old boy would have received 26 rounds of vaccinations in his first 24 months of life here. I mean, it's unreal. And if you recall, there was a meeting with George Bush after 9/11, talking with the heads of all the drug companies about vaccines and so on and all this. And basically, it was an agreement that the government would, you know, back the vaccine makers. And this is exactly what we have. We just wonder if they're just promoting the diseases like bird flu, which is phony, in order to line the pockets of the pharmaceutical companies.
Well, it may very well be. I certainly there's a large profit motive, especially when you're talking about something like $360 for that the new vaccine for human papillomavirus. But as I remember, it's about $180 just for the hepatitis B vaccine, which is totally unnecessary in any child, unless their mother, of course, has hepatitis B. This is a massive program, totally unnecessary, and all sorts of complications. There is no vaccine that we know that is as reactive as the hepatitis B vaccine, because of course it's genetically created, and we get molecular mimicking. In other words, they take a gene off of the virus shell, and they make a vaccine out of that. And what happens is that gene is very, very similar to the gene that you'll find, or the protein molecule you'll find in the myelin sheath. So these children begin to get all sorts of demyelinating diseases. And then folks say, gee, we don't know why these things are happening, but we're sure it's not the vaccine. And yet I've talked to some of the world's leading experts in vaccinology, who assure me that this is the most dangerous vaccine, and now we're giving it to every newborn in the nursery. And you have to ask yourself why, when this is not a problem in the United States. It's a problem in other countries. It's a problem throughout the world. And the reason is because there's such a high incidence of hepatitis B throughout the world. Why is there such a high incidence of hepatitis B? It never used to be like that. We have an epidemic of hepatitis B. We have about 2 billion people in the world who have either have active hepatitis B or have serological evidence of having had it. And most of them got it from vaccine shots, because throughout the world they give massive vaccine programs and they use dirty needles. They don't cleanse the needles. Now, you would think that if we could afford to give the vaccines throughout the world, we could afford to give clean needles. Why won't they use clean needles throughout the world? Well, they say it's so important, we've just got to do it however we can. How could you get 2 billion people with hepatitis B unintentionally?
Well, before we run out of time on the air here tonight, I'm desperate to ask you the question. We do see, 328 million dollars being put up by Bill Gates to create competition between labs all over the world to see if they could take one final shot at developing an AIDS vaccine. Of course, this has been met with failure time and time again. I just wanted your comment on this. It just seems, why would a man waste $328 million when no one's been able to do it before? I just am puzzled.
Well, I would point out the fact that Bill Gates is dedicated to population control. He is also dedicated to immunizing the children throughout the world to save their lives. These two ideas, population control and life-saving, are exactly opposite to one another. And, I have to seriously wonder why Bill Gates wants to spend billions of dollars, vaccinating children throughout the world at the same time he's working on population control. Maybe there's something there we don't know. And as far as I'm concerned about developing an AIDS vaccine, I mean, there's one way to avoid getting AIDS, and that's, of course, to practice what God told us, abstinence before marriage and fidelity after marriage. The last thing we want would be an AIDS vaccine, and then come up with the idea, oh, we've got to vaccinate everybody in the world. We're from Bill Gates Foundation, and we're here to help you. I would be very, very worried about this program of compulsory or suggested or mandatory vaccination for anything, and specifically for AIDS.
Well, I just think it's very strange that a man would put up so much money when it's been said it's impossible, that this is a retrovirus, that it keeps mutating and changing, and simply no way to do it, and yet he's putting all this money in. I'm just puzzled. I don't know where this man's going. Understand, so much of the world would be helped with that money in so many other ways. Even in vaccines we already have that seem to work. So I'm just puzzled why a man would do this. You could save a lot more lives. This money seems like it's going right down the toilet.
Well, unless, of course, it has something to do with his population control agenda. And there really are people who are Malthusian in their outlook, who have a different view of human life, and they may often say that they're compassionate and concerned. But look and see what they're doing. And Bill Gates has been pushing population control, and now he wants to vaccinate the children all throughout the world using the childhood vaccines that have a full dose of thimerosal in them. Why would he want to vaccinate children with this deadly poison, which they've taken out of our childhood vaccines, but left into the vaccines for children throughout the world? doesn't make sense unless maybe there's another agenda.
Well, it's a crazy world, and it seems to be vaccination planet at the moment. That's what they have planned. We're going to have to get smart enough to learn how to skirt around this, and it's our doctors, and, well...
Now, hold on. We'll be back here in just a moment. And let me suggest you go to the National Vaccine Information Center, the Vaccine Information Center. Get their material. Barbara Lowfisher does a great job. Is that the National Vaccine Information Center?
It is NVIC.org.
NVIC.org. Go there. NVIC.org. Go there. Get their information. Learn, because remember, the life you save could be that of your child or even yourself. Well, Bill, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, we do see the Cochrane database. This is a group that is non-profit, agrees to review all the medical treatments and effectiveness of things in the world, tell us whether they really work, look at all the data and analyze it. They're just out with a July 2006 Cochrane database system review of vaccines for preventing influenza in the elderly. Now, that's the main risk group. And what they're finding is the effectiveness of these flu vaccines for the elderly. They're in the range of 23% effectiveness, 35%, 45%. Depends on whether you're in the hospital, nursing home. There's some variances in it, but never gets over 58%. Largely ineffective. Even for pneumonia, they have one here as a vaccine. So, we're lining up, we're vaccinating all these, vulnerable retirees, many of them in a debilitated state in nursing homes. I'm wondering how they're surviving it or if they really are. And there's really no connection made, no studies to really connect a lot of this. I just do believe that it's over-treatment, not needed, and... maybe you should take care of mom at home. Maybe we need to start doing more of that in some way here. So,
yeah, and maybe we ought to start asking why we have so much increase in the incidence of Alzheimer's disease. Why we have such much of an increase in cancer. Why we have so much of an increase in heart disease and strokes. And even comparing them, United States and Great Britain for men, I think 55 to 64, comparable groups, 4,000 each country. We have twice as much cancer, twice as much diabetes, half again as many strokes and heart disease. And the question is, what are we doing wrong? Or maybe we're doing exactly what they intend to do.
I don't know how many viruses there are on the planet, but apparently they want to vaccinate us against all of those. They've started cancer vaccines. There are at least 200 major types of cancer. Are we going to have a vaccine against each of those? They've got a new vaccine out to help people stop smoking. That list is endless.
And I think we're doing an awful lot of harm. Bill, we're out of time. God bless you. Oh, we want to get at your address. It's knowledgeofhealth.com.
Knowledgeofhealth.com. You bet. Thank you.
Well, just hang on. Let's wait till we get our programs, pardon me, our stations back on with us.
Okay.
But our guest this evening has been Bill Sardi of knowledgeofhealth.com. You want to go to his website. There's a lot of great information there. Information you're not going to get elsewhere. And you are responsible for your health, not your doctor, nobody else but you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bill Sardi. Bill, let's get your website out so everybody listening can go there and get the information they need.
KnowledgeofHealth.com. Knowledge of Health. All one word, the way you'd spell it out. And, of course, we do have breaking reports there all the time. You can sign up for a free newsletter, get a free e-book, The Collapse of Conventional Medicine. Lots of free things there. We like the word free. And we have a report up there now on Alzheimer's disease. Tells you it's going to bankrupt Medicare within the next few years, what we can do about it. They've got no drugs that work against it. Some horror stories from medicine and over-medicating, especially older people. The links between mercury and autism and autoimmune disorders and so much more. The medical testing racket, atrial fibrillation many people have in the heart, so on. How to get out of these things. So Lots of good information there for you and your family.
Well, thank you so very much. Really appreciate it, and we'll be talking again a little later this month.
Okay.
God bless. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Bill Sardi, and I do hope that you enjoyed our conversation. We always love to get Bill on. A tremendous wealth of information. He has the scientific studies behind what he's saying. You'll want to go to his website, knowledgeofhealth.com. And then, of course, we do want to mention, of course, here at Radio Liberty, we carry a lot of things that you really need to have. You need to have the book, The Miracle of Magnesium, Death by RX by Dr. Richard Strand. And, of course, we have Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. The Truth About the Drug Companies by Dr. Marshall Angel, we mentioned before. We have a great four-tape set on vaccines. We have a four-tape set on statin drugs, and believe me, they're poisoning you with statin drugs. They're doing very little good, but they're doing an awful lot of harm. And the only thing they're really good for is driving the price of the drug stocks up. You need to know the truth about statin drugs. And what you do, you'll never trust what you're told again. You'll never believe those advertisements on the radio that show the man coming down the long blue spiral staircase. We have a book on statin drugs. We have a four-tape set on statin drugs. You owe it to yourself to find out, because if they're lying to you about statins, what else are they lying to you about? And then, of course, we do hope you want to get Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, which is really so important to understand what's going on. It's called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. If you know how somebody who has cancer and is going to have to take chemotherapy or radiation, you know how to get Dr. Blaylock's book, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients. And if you, of course, if you like Diet Coke or you're concerned about your child's health, you need to learn about the excitotoxins, the aspartame and the MSG. They put in so many things for your children and the deadly consequences of this. We're not exaggerating. We've got a four-tape set on aspartame, and we've got a four-tape set on certainly on autism. We are creating these diseases for damaging the lives and for the future of our children. If you don't understand what they're doing as far as poisoning us with fluoride, you need to get my talk on the hidden agenda. You need to get our syllabus on the hidden agenda. And you'll actually see the scientific studies. You'll see the material from all sorts of reliable publications and begin to understand that there is an organized effort to poison the American people. Why? Because there are too many people in the world, ladies and gentlemen. If you doubt that that is the basis of American foreign policy, you want the documentation, you need to get my talk, Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction, a talk I gave for the Prophecy Club, and it's really rather well done. If you can stand listening to me talk for 2 hours and 20 minutes, but there are a lot of certainly pictures and other things, and the documentation is there. And then, of course, it's up to you to find out. Maybe we're lying to you, and maybe there's no truth to this. If you want to get Dr. MacArthur's testimony before the House Appropriations Committee, we're asked for $10 million to create an entirely new disease that would destroy the immune system. We have it. If you want to get the National Security Study Memorandum 200 that talks about how we've got to control the population of the world, all of these things are available from Radio Liberty. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff or sponsors of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And this evening we've got Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And, of course, these are very, very dangerous times we're in. Suddenly, today I was reading from several sources that North Korea is beginning to mobilize its military forces. What in heaven's name is North Korea doing mobilizing its military forces? President Hu of China has met with Putin. Why is Hu going to see Putin? And then, of course, we know that somewhere 900,000 Lebanese are streaming into Syria to try to get away from the war. The war seems to be increasing its tempo in the Near East. The war in the Middle East seems to be increasing its tempo. Over 100 people a day are being slaughtered in Baghdad. And America, gee shucks, we just don't know what to do. Can't figure out why this is happening. We've got a civil war there, but there's nothing we can do about that. We're just going to have to stay and keep our men there indefinitely. Well, with that as a background, Joel Skousen, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure as always, Dr. Stan.
Well, these are exciting times, and we want to get your thoughts on what's going on.
Well, there's definitely appears to be a sea change in the way that Israel is operating vis-a-vis the international community. It's usually the United States, along with the international community, that is keeping Israel from pursuing any military objective, any retaliation against an attack, such as the rocket attacks by Hezbollah. Keep them restrained. United States is right there at the forefront to make sure that a complete military victory is never possible. However, this time it's different. Not only is this not a short incursion, this is only partially attacking Hezbollah. Lebanon itself is taking the lion's share of the aerial attack by Israel. It's almost as if they have copied the plan book from the United States in destroying Kosovo and Serbia as a means, to bringing the country to its knees, and mostly targeting industrial and civilian targets rather than military. So it's a very, very sad situation. That's my major objective, even as a supporter of Israel's right to exist and a biblical supporter of the biblical confines and eventual destiny of Israel. I do believe that their government is a globalist government that is not working in the best interests of the country, but feigning, acting tough occasionally, but they never do completely eradicate the problem, because I think they bought into the globalist argument that you manage conflict as a means to a larger globalist end.
Well, I share your concern, and certainly reading some of the things that some of the plans of the internationalists like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl, back in the mid-1960s, it was almost as if we're beginning to follow the plan they laid out in something called A Clean Break. Do you know that treatise?
Yes, I'm very familiar. I read summaries of The Clean Break, and this is following it very, very closely. There's really no rational military purpose for most of the constant day and night bombardment of Lebanon, in particular the civilian targets, the non-military industrial plants and roads and bridges. This is a very serious destruction of a country that was really the oasis of the Middle East.
And it's almost like they're trying to bomb it back into the Stone Age.
Precisely.
800,000 to 900,000 Lebanese, ladies and gentlemen, have fled for their lives. And, of course, this is going to totally disrupt Syria. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Joel picked this story up because, of course, so much of what's going on from a logical point of view doesn't make sense. And as I often point out to our listeners, if you're looking for a logical explanation, you're not going to find it. There's always another explanation behind what we're being told.
Well, and that's a key element of my analysis, Dr. Stan, is that when things really don't follow a rational military pattern, then you know that there's ulterior motives and agendas involved here, and that's the main thrust of this week's brief, which just came out today. I think you've probably got a copy.
I did, but I haven't had a chance to read it. I'd hoped to, but anyway, go ahead and explain, because you deal with this extensively in the beginning.
Yes, I certainly do. Last week as well, I dealt with what I felt were the overall globalist involvement of Israeli leaders and why they never do follow up and eradicate the problems. They always stop short. Of course, there's an international ceasefire that's always called. But this time it's very interesting that Condoleezza Rice and President Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, specifically pointed out that we will not call for a ceasefire that will keep the status quo. In other words, we're going to honor Israel's desire to completely eradicate Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Well, I do, have a feeling, though, as you analyze this, that really this is a war of proxies. This is really a war between the United States and Iran, but our proxy is Israel. Iran's proxy is Hezbollah and Hamas. Is that what do you think about that?
It appears that it's going to be true in the long term. Whether or not this is going to actually provoke an attack on Iran, that's one of the possibilities I discussed in this week's brief. But it appears. Now, the latest intelligence that I've got out of Israel today indicates that, first of all, this military plan is already a year old, and of course, like the United States, they pre-plan military attacks when they know that it's inevitable that Hezbollah is going to, regroup and reform after they left and essentially gave it back to them, southern Lebanon, in 2000. And they knew that they were going to have a problem again. This indicates that it was political folly to withdraw unilaterally as they did in the first place. But in any case, this plan is a year old. Military sources have indicated that this is a three-week plan. We're in the second week of a three-week plan, and it's going right according to plan, and Israel and the United States have agreed they're going to allow the whole plan to go through, that they do not intend to occupy Lebanon, which is a very, very difficult proposition for a small country like Israel, who depends on reservists for their military service.
Hold that thought there. We'll be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen. Well, Joel, go right ahead and pick the story up.
The issue of reservists is very important in Israel. I mean, a large part of the Israeli army works full-time in regular jobs and in these reserve obligations. This is a real hardship on the Israeli economy when you pull reservists out, for a long-term military conflict. And in this case, it doesn't look like they're going to do that. They're going to go through this next week. They're already building for the ground attack. They're going to do a concerted ground attack, I believe, against Hezbollah and try to wipe out its major military concentrations. Now, Hezbollah is a very, very expert fourth-generation or asymmetrical conflict group. These people are very, very disciplined. They're a mobile guerrilla force. It's very doubtful if they're going to get more than a third of Hezbollah fighters. Now, that's a significant degradation of Hezbollah's military capacity, but I think that Hezbollah will and is preparing at this moment to recede into the winds and to avoid a major hit. They are going to fight out. They're going to try to damage Israeli military forces and kill as many soldiers as they can in this conflict. They're going to take some hits themselves. But I think that the problem with this whole three-week plan that Israel has decided to do that doesn't involve an occupation, there's two major aspects. One, I think they've taken a lesson from the U.S. and they're using the bombing campaign to prep up and soften not only the guerrilla areas, but Lebanon itself. And I don't understand why they're trying to do this to Lebanon unless it's to follow the U.S. plan of antagonizing the Muslim world. If they're dovetailing with the U.S. onto this long-term strategic goal of creating a recipe for retribution against the United States, against Israel, that's the way to do it, is to bomb a relatively innocent country. And I talk about the relative innocence of Lebanon. It's one thing to harbor terrorists as Syria does and as Lebanon does, or as Iran does. But Lebanon is a relatively weak military. It's a very divided country. It doesn't have the military power, frankly, even though it has the numbers of troops. They're very poorly trained. They're mostly Shiite, which won't fight against Hezbollah. So it's not a reasonable thing to say that Hezbollah or that Lebanon should have removed Hezbollah as a military force. They simply did not have the power to do that, especially since they were under Syrian control until last year. So I don't hold Lebanon fully responsible. Lebanon has gone through a nearly complete multi-billion dollar reconstruction since the major Israeli incursions in the late 80s against the PLO, where the Reagan administration and the Marines took such a beating and then rescued the PLO. I mean, it was just a complete...
It was insanity. I mean, the Israelis were ready to wipe out the PLO when the Reagan administration intervened, demanded a ceasefire, then whisked the PLO away, the Palestinian Liberation
Army.
I mean,
this is globalist tactics. Right. This is managing conflict, Dr. Stan, so that they live again to create another conflict another day until you get the desired result.
And it didn't make sense that they would rescue the Palestinian Liberation Army and then whisk it off to Tunisia and rearm it and send it back into Palestine, unless you wanted the continued conflict.
Yeah, and we have the Gaza situation today because we let Fatah and the PLO take up residence there, and through the secret Oslo Agreement, we gave them military power, we armed them through the Israelis, and look what we've got. We've got now rocket factories and mortars being thrown daily into Israel. And none of that needed to happen, except that Israel itself fomented that. I covered in the briefs how Israel fomented the secret bank accounts and helped Arafat set up his secret bank accounts in Switzerland and advised them on how to set up the shell companies so that they could transfer funds overseas. There's an incestuous relationship there between the Israeli government and the terrorists, just as there is between the U.S. government and certain terrorist organizations that they control for political purposes. As you have said so eloquently, the world is not as people see it. The illusions are very, very great. But in any case, in the Middle East, we have a situation where Hezbollah is very mobile. Hezbollah is a typical guerrilla-type organization. They can blend within the people. They have a great deal of support within the people of southern Lebanon, who have been driven out, by the way. Although this is rather problematic. Israel drops leaflets telling all the people to leave, but they bombed all the roads and bridges, so it's almost impossible to drive. And how do you drive to Beirut? A lot of these cars in convoys have been struck by Israeli aircraft, even after they followed instructions to evacuate. And this is very, very sad to see this happening. Now, I'm not sure how much of that is deliberate or if any of it is deliberate. But this type of thing happens. It happened in the Kosovo War. One courageous Air Force pilot refused to bomb a civilian convoy. But apparently he was given orders, even a second time after he refused, that he was to bomb that convoy, even when he told the AWACS aircraft that he was civilian. I don't know if exactly what happened here, unless the Russians were eavesdropping on the Israeli AWACS, as they were on the U.S. AWACS in Kosovo. That's how we found out about this conversation between the poor pilot and his higher officers doing this. But, these are war crimes, frankly. When you have that kind of conversation, there's no one to prosecute, obviously, because the U.S. has so much power to control those types of things. But these are very, very sad commentaries, and many, many tragedies have occurred among the over 300 dead and thousands of wounded in Lebanon, and the doctors are just frantic because these people are women and children mostly that are coming into the hospitals. These are not soldiers. They're not dressed in soldiers' uniforms, and most of them are, and hardly any of them are men. So I don't know where all the casualties are being inflicted if Israel is in fact taking on Hezbollah, but the casualties coming into the hospitals are women and children. And this is what I protest, even as I defend Israel's right to exist. I protest the way that this war is being done, exactly as I have protested the way that the U.S. has been fighting these wars by bombing whole cities in Iraq just because it has insurgents in there. They are loath to go in and do the root-them-out-of-the-house routine But if the only way that you can deal with an insurgency, I don't care how difficult it is, I don't care how many casualties, that's the only way to keep from killing innocent civilians. You don't do it with bombing. And, you know, the American people see this precision bombing on videotape, and they think, look, the crosshairs are right on the window, the bomb went right through the window, but the bomb is big enough to blow out three houses. Now, that's indiscriminate. I don't care how precision the bombing is a bomb, and it's too powerful to not have indiscriminate consequences. And that's my objection to this infatuation with air power. It's just not discriminating enough because it's overkill in most situations.
Well, I share your concern. I share your concern about what's happening in Afghanistan and what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Lebanon, what's happening in Gaza, and what's happening in the Palestinian area of Israel. But even more, you know, you can just see how the Arabs throughout the world will be mobilizing in their hatred against America. This is the thing, and I don't think that you could do such a poor job from a propaganda point of view or from a psychological point of view unintentionally. We have to know we're inflaming the Arab population of the world against the United States. And in years past, the Arabs were very friendly towards America and very predisposed to us, but I don't believe that's the case any longer. I think increasingly is growing hatred.
And especially in Lebanon, Dr. Stan, Lebanon has always been one of the most modern of the Arab countries. It's been one of the least restrictive in terms of fundamentalist Muslim beliefs. People were free, you know, to have their coffee houses and their cinemas and their movies. It was very westernized, very, very modern. A lovely city, Beirut, with its palm trees and its beaches and its ports, just a lovely city, and it was rebuilt. Even sentiment towards Israel was quite favorable before this. I mean, Israel has literally blown away all of the goodwill that they created by leaving Lebanon alone for so many years and withdrawing unilaterally from southern Lebanon. They have betrayed their Christian allies, and they even started bombing one of the Christian ally neighborhoods the other day, showing that even past friends are not immune from this kind. I mean, this appears to be pure antagonism of Lebanon. I can see no other explanation for it. It's almost as if the U.S. and Israel simply do not want any Muslim country to feel like it's exempt from the neocon globalist attacks on them.
And, of course, we're making a big issue of getting the 25,000 Americans out, but totally ignoring the 700,000 or 900,000, Lebanese who are fleeing for their lives. What are we doing to help them? And absolutely nothing. So it's only the Americans we're concerned about. Aren't the other people important?
Well, one of the interesting things about that is that, you know, evacuating 25,000 Americans, and actually, in reality, only about half of those are going to lead because the other half are Lebanese Americans who prefer to stay there. But in any case, it's a nightmare going to Cyprus. They're all filled up right now, and it's very, very difficult to get any kind of accommodations. It's high tourist season in Cyprus. They're very, very much put upon by the international community to accept all of these refugees. And it's not just, 25,000 Americans. There are 20,000 Brits and approximately 22,000 other Europeans that are trying to get out of there as well. Not to mention, the almost a million refugees streaming into Syria. So this is a very, very difficult problem. By the mere size of removing this many people, it indicates...
Joel, can you hear me?
Yes.
Joel, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, where did I cut out?
I don't know. Something terrible happened, but whatever it was. You were just talking about the million people who were streaming, who were trying to get away.
Well, what my major point was is that the U.S. would not be going to all of the expense of removing 25,000 Americans and the Brits removing 20,000 of their citizens in Lebanon. If this were going to be ending even next week, they would be encouraging them to stay. But in fact, the three-week plan of Israel may be potentially over next week, but the repercussions of this are going to go on for months. This is going to be an economy in shambles. It's going to be no telling how long before they get power and water and food supplies back in. This is going to be no place to live for many years to come. So this is very, very sad and very unfortunate.
I think this is really a great tragedy, and of course I think it's going to have all sorts of complications, but what do you think? Do you think it's going to end here in another couple of weeks?
Well, it appears, since Israel is stating categorically that they are not going to occupy Lebanon, it appears that it's probably going to go on no more than 1 or 2 weeks before they pull back. Now, it could go in longer. The U.S., given that they're not calling for a ceasefire, you know, essentially Condoleezza Rice is going with a negotiating position to Lebanon and Hezbollah that cannot be fulfilled. Hezbollah said categorically, after this kind of retaliation, you're not getting your soldiers back, period, unless you have a massive prisoner swap. I don't care if you beat us, we'll kill the soldiers, he said, before we'll give them back to you without a prisoner swap, and I think he means it. So that's that for, you know, Israel really is paying for the overkill against Lebanon. They have engendered so much bad will.
But don't you really think that this was all planned ahead of time? In other words, they use the capture of the prisoners as a justification for what they're doing.
Absolutely. In fact, Barry Chamish gave a very interesting analysis of how it appeared as if the Israeli government itself set up its soldiers to be kidnapped. In other words, they sent in some tanks into Lebanon without the normal support of a column of tanks to make it easy to capture. The same thing happened with the video, the security video, the capture of you know, the Corporal Shalit in Gaza. The video shows him asking for permission to fire upon the people who were coming in to essentially attack them, who ended up kidnapping this guy, and his officer refused permission for him to fire. So somebody was not following standard operating procedures, and it could be that Israel, in essence, was looking for this opportunity to launch this three-week plan, pre-planned military attack on Gaza and Hezbollah and southern Lebanon.
And of course, you know, we see this pattern over and over again. We could talk about the bombing of the coal. They knew the coal was going to be attacked. Or daily, of course, when you bring an American ship into port, you have all your guns armed, you have people there, big signs, don't come close to the ship. My son was on an aircraft carrier. That's what they did. They brought the coal in to a hostile port, and they didn't even have any of the guns with any ammunition in them. I believe they left the coal to be attacked. I think they knew exactly what they were doing, and I can't help but wonder if what we're seeing with the kidnapping of the Israeli soldiers is another example of deja vu all over again. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Joel Skousen. And Joel, pick the story up from there.
So let's consider the major question I posed in this week's World Affairs Brief. What's Israel really up to? Now, it's obvious that this were planned a year in advance. They picked the targets in Lebanon, the bridges, and even some beautiful architectural bridges way up in northern Lebanon that had nothing to do with Hezbollah or any retreat from Hezbollah. And spans were dropped on that beautiful architectural bridge. I mean, these are just, there's no reason for this other than antagonism. But let's consider the benefit of the doubt, the official version of Israel, that they're really intending on rooting out Israel. Now, I don't believe it for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you don't intend to occupy southern Lebanon, or even the middle part of Lebanon, clear up to the Syrian border, there's no way that you can keep Hezbollah from reforming itself. I mean, this is a terrorist organization that's very, very capable. All of these are Shiites there in central and in southern Lebanon. So it's going to be impossible to tell who's a guerrilla and who's not, unless you occupy the country. And even if you occupy it, the U.S. has shown it's extremely difficult when you don't speak the language, for Americans to go in and root out terrorists, without just doing a lot of damage to civilians and arresting a lot of people who shouldn't be arrested. Now, it might be said that the Israelis are much, much better at speaking the various languages, and telling who's who. I mean, the Israelis can go in there, if they occupied southern Lebanon or central and southern Lebanon, they could eventually kill Hezbollah. But by stating from the outset that they are not going to occupy, that means they're simply going to hit them as hard as they can until they withdraw, and then Hezbollah is going to reform again. So this is not rooting out Hezbollah. I just don't believe that this is intent. I know what it would take to root them out, and they're not going to do that, because it would take occupation to do it. Israel could do it. They've never done it before. They've never eradicated any of their enemies. And prior to this time, it's been because of international and U.S. pressure that they've withdrawn from full military victory. But now we see that the Israeli government itself has joined forces with the globalists and is using self-imposed globalist restraints on the military planners in order to keep victory from occurring. Now, the second possibility is that they're setting up Lebanon, as various pundits have said this, they're setting Lebanon up to force the fall of the current government and replacing it with a puppet government that will be more friendly to Israel's long-term security objectives. Now, I also doubt this. If Israel has bought into the U.S. pattern of occupying countries, not for peace and democracy, as we say, but for provocation and antagonism, this might be a possibility. But you can't install and force a puppet government upon Lebanon, as the U.S. did in Iraq, unless you occupy the country once again. Only an occupier with a stranglehold on the reconstruction, supply of electricity, food, water, as in Iraq, the oil supplies, and access to daily arm-twisting sessions, as Ambassador Khalilzad has in Baghdad, you just can't manipulate the political forces sufficiently to cause a puppet government. So the longer this air attack goes on, the more likely it is that Israel will invade and occupy. So they have said now they're not going to occupy. The air attack's probably going to stop pretty soon, and the ground invasion will start this next week, I believe. But if they simply stop right now, certainly they've accomplished nothing but sting Hezbollah and make them really mad, as well as Lebanon itself. Israel is now hated more in Lebanon than ever before. Even Lebanese Christians have stopped verbalizing any support for Israel. And this is bad for Israel in the long run. So if the government if the country becomes ungovernable, it's possible the government may quit in disgust or be even removed by Hezbollah. Pro-Syrian forces will certainly fill in the vacuum if this tacitly anti-Syrian government falls or is deemed incapable of having protected the country. So much could happen in terms of which way Lebanon goes. Let me see. The third possibility, of course, is that Israel, in collusion with the U.S., may have decided to antagonize Lebanon in order to incite Syria and Iran into some overt act that will finally justify a joint U.S. attack on Iran or Syria.
And of course, that is what really frightens me, and that was one of the things they talked about in the clear break back in the mid-1990s, that they would use whatever incident to justify invading Syria. And when we get back, I want to get your view on that. But, I mean, expanding this war is going to, in my estimation, lay open a possibility that things are going to go some way that they don't anticipate. You know, when you start a war, you're never quite sure how it's going to end. Now, I believe usually we know exactly what we're doing, but sometimes I think the people in charge have an overinflated opinion of their own intelligence, and, well, we saw what happened in previous wars that had unintended consequences. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. Joel, pick up the story from there.
So we're discussing the the possibility that that this antagonism of Lebanon is meant to provoke a defensive reaction out of Iran and Syria. Webster G. Tarpley of the Online Journal, this is a leftist publication, agrees with this. He says, the escalating Israeli assault on Lebanon clearly represents a conscious bid to provoke a general war in the Middle East. The captured Israeli soldiers are only the pretext for the present massive military operations. Well, my view now is that it does appear as if this is not going to go into full-scale war, certainly because Iran and Syria are not showing any willingness to be drawn into this. There is a possibility, I point out in the brief, that Israel could find some pretext for bombing or actually attacking Hezbollah headquarters outside of Damascus in order to provoke a Syrian reaction. But Syria appears to see that something's really different going on. They're very, very wary about getting drawn into an actual overt war. So even that may not do it.
And if I was reading apparently some Israeli jets had buzzed the palace of the Assad, who's the
Bashar al-Assad,
right?
Yes.
Right. That actually buzzed the palace. Now that, in many respects, is an act of war. I mean, that provocation. But, you know, of course, it didn't do any harm. They just buzzed the palace as if they were just trying to antagonize the ruler of Syria, to get him to do something in response, or maybe to shoot at those planes or something.
Right.
And then they could justify going to war with him.
Syria has provided by the Russians a lot of SAM missiles that are very, very effective, and they haven't used any against the Israeli incursion so far. So apparently they are trying to avoid any confrontation. One of the hypocrisies of this situation is that, you know, the U.S. and Israel continue to make the link between Hezbollah and Iran and Syria, especially involved in the missiles, but they fail to point the finger at China, who supplied those missiles, including the C-802 that, you know, was a radar-guided missile that hit the Israeli patrol boat out in the Mediterranean that was enforcing the blockade on Lebanon. And, of course, China is very much involved in these surrogate nations, and the U.S. is still protecting Russia and China. Russia, of course, was the main supplier and trainer of the PLO, and China has now kind of taken over so that Russia can play the role which they're doing internationally as a semi-ally in the war on terror. The U.S. knows that that isn't true, but they continue to play as if it is.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and go right ahead, Joel. Pick the story up there.
So evidence for this scenario of the trying to provoke an attack from Iran and Syria so that they can counterattack or have an excuse to begin an aerial attack on Iran is that, of course, the U.S. has for the first time not put pressure on Israel to have an immediate ceasefire. Number two, the Israel U.S. Ambassadors, including Ambassador to the UN, Josh Bolton, continue to bring up the subject of Iranian and Syrian backing of Hezbollah, which is true. The U.S. is also piggybacking the North Korean missile threat into this Middle East crisis. The U.S. conveniently leaked intelligence yesterday claiming that Iranians were present in North Korea to observe the launching of the seven missiles in North Korea, putting them, of course, on the bad guy list. Now, the U.S. has long known that North Korean missile transfers of both technology and parts has been in the process of helping Iran build its intermediate-range Shahed-2 missiles. Then why was the U.S. silent when all these missile transfers were going on between North Korea and Iran? Why did they, with all the satellite photos they've got of the missiles disembarking in the ports there and being shipped to Iran, I guess they were saving this intelligence for later on when they could provoke a war.
Well, of course, the other thing that bothers me is that we are building up China's military capacity. China certainly is helping North Korea build these missiles. A country that can't even feed its own people can't be building sophisticated, missiles that, can be radar guided or can be have the capacity to be as accurate. So it has to be that China is helping the North Koreans, and we're helping Communist China. And none of this makes sense from a logical point of view unless this is all preparing for a major world confrontation.
Yes, that's right. And these are very difficult things for normal analysts to want to see because it's very unpopular. It's amazing to see how people shy away from subjects. You know, the people that are called to be interviewed on television are very predictable. They'll steer away from any attack on Russia and China. Of course, Iran and Syria are the bad guy. You know, the U.S. neocons really are itching for this Iranian invasion. Rush Limbaugh is now saying that this war in the Middle East was, quote, never intended to stop with Iraq. This is finally our chance to go after Iran. Maybe he knows something that Americans don't know, because it's certainly true what he says, but, you know, it never was intended to stop with Iraq. I'm just as sure that the U.S. intends to strike Iran as I was that they... when they were disclaiming any military intentions of going to Iraq, meanwhile, while they were planning that very attack. And he, you know, he puts it in terms of this conflict of civilizations, which really isn't necessarily true. You know, the Muslims would be really quite content to live among themselves. They've never, you know, passed the Ottoman Empire, had the capability of taking on the West, and they still don't. They've always been pawns of the larger powers, Russia, the British, the French. But as he puts it, Rush Limbaugh puts it, there will be no peace until one side finally defeats the other completely. And that's frankly just not going to happen. I mean, you simply cannot, you know, defeat a people like the Arabs who have many, many childlike personalities that can be inflamed so easily. And in the attacks, it just takes years for these people to get over the feelings of revenge and the hatred. And when you have a theology that allows for this provocation, this jihadism, this ability to project the martyrship into heaven with, you know, all of the worldly and sensual promises that they give them, it's very, you know, that kind of religion would not you know, play with the thinking people, but it does play well with a very childlike mentality. And you know, one of the things that I noticed over there, and when I was in Israel among the Arabs and the Israelis, that they are very, very different people. You can whip many of the Arabs up into a frenzy, and although there are very many intelligent, well-educated Americans here, you find that this mentality over there, I mean, I have seen Arab children, you know, stand around in a circle and just torture an animal to death and delight in it and yell and jump up and down as if this was just a supreme pleasure. You just never see Jewish children doing that over there. There is a difference between them. And although I, you know, there are always exceptions to these rules, there's something about the delight in skinning people alive and torture that a certain class of Arabs can get involved in that is very, very scary in terms of their ability to be self-governing.
Well, of course, you know, I look upon Rush Limbaugh pretty well as a spokesman for the Council on Foreign Relations and the Establishment. And then, of course, we hear Newt Gingrich coming out and saying we're in World War III, and of course, Newt is a spokesman for the neoconservative CFR crowd as well. So you wonder what they're doing, why they're trying to prime us for this, unless maybe they're pushing us in that direction. Have you had that thought?
Well, some are and some aren't pushing. You know, the real true neocons, like Irving Kristol of the Weekly Standard, he had an essay this week entitled Our War, complaining that Bush administration has done a poor job of standing up and weakening Syria and Iran, calling upon President Bush to leave the silly Group of Eight summit in Petersburg and fly to Jerusalem, the capital of a nation that stands with us, willing to fight with us against our common enemies. And this is just warmongering speech.
Sure.
He knows what he's doing.
Of course, here, Irving Kristol is the leader of the Project for the New American Century.
Yes, a true neocon. But you have your yes-men Christian evangelicals like Reverend Hagee, who claimed there's a new Hitler in the Middle East, referring to Iranian President Ahmadinejad. The only way we will stop will be by a preemptive military strike in Iran. And these people just are ignorantly trying to feel like that Bush is their man, trying to invoke biblical prophecy that since it's the will of God that Israel be returned to its land, that what the government is doing must be right. And neither our government nor the government of Israel, in my opinion, are godly people, are Christian people, or even true to the Jewish faith. These people are hostile to religion generally. And they are simply, as I explain it, globalists working to foment conflict so as that they can create the atmosphere that will eventually create a major retaliation, not only against Israel, but the United States as the major supporter of Israel. That retaliation will end up eventually as World War III. Now, this is not World War III. Newt Gingrich keeps parading around his latest electioneering slogan that we're in World War III and we have to prosecute this war on terror, but this is not World War III. The United States will be preemptively struck by China and Russia in a major nuclear attack sometime in the next decade, in my opinion, and then Americans will finally see what World War III is really like. And our leaders are simply preparing the way for that kind of antagonism to be generated so that Russia and China can feel justified in the eyes of the world in provoking an attack on the United States. That's a very sobering prediction, but as I see it, that's the only reason to explain why the United States is covering for Russian and Chinese war preparations and not, in fact, pointing them out as the true axis of evil.
Well, not only that, but actually actively building up communist China's military potential. I mean, you couldn't do that unintentionally. We're even transferring some of our major war-making machines or major technology to them that we would need to build our own weapons. And they're going to, you know, if we get into a war with them, we're going to have to get the parts for our missiles from communist China. I mean, how could anybody do anything like that so stupidly?
Well, it's been going on a long time, and you have to see the panoramic view of the historical view of the U.S. assisting communist revolutions throughout history for over 60 years. And not only that, they've been facilitating, of course, communist espionage, both Russian and Chinese, within our weapons laboratories. These scientists from Russia and China have access, controlled access to our laboratories. You and I can't even visit them without, even with special permission. So it's very, very real what's going on, the covering of these two predator nations as they prepare to take us down. And as I've said on your program before, I think the ultimate globalist purpose is to create a World War III into which the United States military will be taken down in a major week-long preemptive strike so that the United States, our leaders, will come out of their bunkers and say to our own surviving people, and most people will survive it, by the way, that the Russians deceived us, we didn't know. We have no choice now but to add our military, what strength we have left, to the New World Order, to join with all the rest of the nations, the United Nations, give them military power to defeat this great new enemy. And we'll have the great patriotic war all over again, and naive Americans, just as they've gone along after 9/11, in believing the provocations of our own government will believe this next war, and it will take us into globalist controls that we've never yet known. So far we've dealt with a lot of voluntary things. They've been careful not to antagonize the majority of Americans or let them be too open about it. The one thing that they have failed, by the way, recently is in the immigration bill, the amnesty proposal. Bush, President Fox, admitted on Mexican TV that in his latest conversation at the G8 summit with President Bush, Bush admitted that he had lost the battle to get the amnesty this year and he'll have to wait for another time. That there isn't enough time with all the problems going on in the United States, with Congress, with the things going on, that they're just not going to get it through.
Well, I really think that this is to the credit of the small group of people who've been emailing and faxing and calling their congressmen, and I believe that the members of Congress were frankly afraid to go ahead with this amnesty legislation, and now they're holding all these meetings across the country. They're just simply, it's all showbiz, but they're afraid to do anything before November, because the congressmen have been reading the polls, and the only people that have lower ratings than the president, who is about 31 or 32% approval, is Congress, that is down around 25%. So they're afraid. They know the people are up in arms, and I say that the credit of the people, who've been calling and writing and emailing, why just keep it up.
The problem, of course, is these people will never take no for an answer. They'll be back, and they'll be back until they wear us down. They always get their way. And that's what is discouraging. That doesn't mean that we can stop fighting, because in the fighting process, in the process of doing what you're doing, doing what I'm doing, we do alert more and more newer people, and we keep them from being sucked in to the blind patriotism that has taken down so many Christian conservatives in this country. And it is out of those people who know what's going on that I believe that God will create a remnant, that in whatever's coming through this new world order, that he'll be able to work with a remnant who can see through it, and will not be convinced of the benevolence of this new world order, as most people are about the war on terror.
I agree with you totally. I think we're talking to the remnant. Those of you out there in the listening audience tonight, go on shortwave and the internet and satellite and listening on radio stations. And this is why I have Joel on, because I think he's absolutely right. We want to reach as many people as we can and hopefully turn them to the Lord. This is what it's all about.
You know, there's another interesting story I covered in this week's brief. Incredibly, with all the tensions boiling in Lebanon, the City of London permitted an Islamic demonstration which was clearly an act of in-your-face provocation. Can you imagine the following signs being paraded up and down the middle of New York after 9/11 and tolerated by the police? Quote, slay or butcher those who insult Islam. Quote, Europe will pay, demolition is on the way. Another sign, Europe will pay, 9/11 is on the way. Quote, behead those who insult Islam. I mean, these were masked Muslims being given a parade permit in the middle of the City of London. I mean...
But, Joel, did you ever stop and think that maybe they want to create this animosity between the British people and the Muslim immigrants, that what they're doing now is creating a situation where the English will hate, the natives will hate the Muslims, and of course then the Muslims will return with emotional hatred of the country they live in. You would not allow something like that. It would not be done unless it was for a psychological purpose.
And that is my point that I was making, is that we know from prior arrests of phony terrorists that the U.S., Britain, and Canada have roving agent provocateurs infiltrating mosques, Muslim schools, and every gathering of Muslims looking for malcontents in order to radicalize them. These people in the street had these signs, had to have been known to government people. They are at best letting this happen, and at worst, provoking it to happen. I mean, somebody had to assure these people. I mean, none of these things are spontaneous. You don't get a major demonstration without people organizing. There were multiple signs of the same type. That means they got together. Someone presented them a list of signs to make. A lot of these people don't know how to print in English. And these things came out as that. And I also pointed out, Toby Harnden, a Canadian reporter, writes that Muslim leaders in Canada have reacted with fury after a radical advocate of the Sharia law revealed that he had been a government spy who helped uncover an alleged Al-Qaeda plot. His name is Mubin Sheikh. He's 29 years old. He came forward to confirm that he was recruited by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, that's equivalent to MI5 or the CIA, and directed a 10-day winter training course in guerrilla tactics for Muslim malcontents in Canada.
It's like this last week we found out about Padilla, the fellow who's going to make the dirty bomb. We've had him in solitary confinement for 4 years.
Yeah.
Then we find out that he was approached by the government to become an agent provocateur or an informant, and when he refused, then they arrested him.
Yes. Well, things aren't what they're saying.
Nothing is as it appears to be. And where's all this talk about the dirty bomb? Did they indict him for a dirty bomb? Absolutely not.
No.
It was because he wouldn't go along with their plans that they put him in solitary confinement for 3 years. And he was an American citizen. If they can do it to Padilla, they can do it to anyone in the listening audience.
The only non-government provoked so-called terrorists that they've arrested and prosecuted have been black converts, American black converts to Muslims who have criminal history, who have had a long-term Marxist communist background, and who have a built-in hatred and inbred dislike for America. These people are very, very easy on their own to get on the bandwagon to start looking for Al-Qaeda and not realizing that Al-Qaeda is really U.S. Secret Services. And when they go hunting for them, they find agent provocateurs, and they're very easy to take down and be brought to justice. I frankly don't think we have real live terrorism. With open borders, certainly we'd have many, many more normal terrorist acts in this country instead of these few high-profile attacks, which are too good to be true, are beyond the capability of any terrorist, even with millions of dollars, because you've got to have inside access to buildings as they had in 9/11 to put the demolition charges in the World Trade Center. These things just don't add up, but it takes a lot of study to be able to see a broad spectrum of evidence in order to come to these conclusions.
In fact, many people out there talk about the London bombing, not that the bombs were inside the subways, they were under the carriages. And
that's right.
It almost sounds like that's exactly what happened in India. And who benefited from the Indian bombing? Why, now we can play the Indians against the Pakistanis and the Pakistanis against the Indians. But people don't like to think about that sort of thing, but I fear this is what's really going on all across the world. We'll be back in just a minute with Joel Skousen. Well, our guest is Joel Skousen. Joel, I got so involved in our program, I forgot to get your address out and how people can get the World Affairs Brief.
If people are interested in reading my weekly World Affairs Brief, they can go to my website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. There's a lot of material there, including each day's update on the latest news that my research staff culls out from all the millions of stories. They pick the best and put them on, and those are the stories I comment on each week, telling what goes on behind the scenes, essentially. There is a modest subscription fee for the World Affairs Brief, and you can subscribe right online. So I encourage people to go to the worldaffairsbrief.com website and read away. There's a great deal in the archives. Everything on the website itself there is free. You can look at all of my previous articles on the major cover-ups the government has been involved in, as well as control of the news, many additional stories that I think you'll find interesting.
And I would recommend it to you, and of course it's the most economical of the newsletters out there, but it's worth a great deal more than it costs. Well, I certainly appreciate so much of your being with us tonight. I've missed having you on. One thing, you've given us three options as far as the Near East is concerned. Do you have any guess which way it's going to go, or should we just wait and see?
Yes, I do think that it's going to end up with a withdrawal after they've hit Hezbollah as hard as they can and wait for another opportunity. I don't think this one's going to lead to the trigger event that they may have anticipated. And they're perfectly willing to wait because the U.S. is the globalists are patient. They've got a long-term view, and there'll be another provocation later on.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest this evening has been Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we've been talking about this terrible tragedy that's unfolding in the Middle East that I personally feel is being utilized very effectively to turn the hatred of the Muslim world against America and certainly against Israel. Well, Joel, good night, and thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Good night. All right, fine. Well, I hope our listeners out there have enjoyed the program. I hope you'll go to worldaffairsbrief.com, as I do first thing every morning after I read my emails, and get the information about what is really transpiring. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. And then, of course, maybe you'll want to go ahead and subscribe to it. It's an inexpensive situation. And I can tell you every week I enjoy Joel's commentary because he has access to information you're not going to have elsewhere. He has contacts with intelligence people who've been intelligence. He himself is an intelligence. And he will give you an entirely different view of what's going on at worldaffairsbrief.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to helping us. We're really dependent upon those of you who believe, as I do, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, as much as you can afford, why, you'll get our four best tapes and or CDs in the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, you'll be helping us beyond our stations all across America. And we have a small but growing network, and with about 60 outlets every week. Some of them are shortwave, some are internet, some are satellite. But we are reaching people who would never, under other circumstances, have any opportunity to hear the truth. Because whether you know it or not, the media in America is controlled.
If you doubt that, you need to read the book, The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Bogdakian. And, of course, you need, of course, to listen to such things as my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness, or certainly get the book of that subject. We have a wonderful interview with the Professor Sutton before he died. The best enemies money could buy. Most Americans find it difficult to believe that we started funding Russian communism back in 1918, that we brought the communist Chinese to power in China after the Second World War, that we brought Fidel Castro to power in 1958 or 59. And so you want to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you want to see my interview with Professor Sutton. In fact, we even financed the North Vietnamese indirectly all during the Vietnam War, so we could keep that senseless war going for 10 long bloody years and kill off as many Vietnamese and Americans as possible and serve no useful purpose at all, exactly as is going on in Iraq today. And you could not do such a poor job unintentionally. Send in inadequate forces, refuse to build up the Iraqi army, to everything you can to not to give them the weapons that they need to demoralize them. And then, of course, you obviously have Asian provocateurs there. And we know, of course, in one instance, they arrested several British soldiers dressed as Arabs who had killed one Iraqi policeman and wounded another. And what was their punishment? Why, nothing at all. They were rescued from the Iraqi jail where they imprisoned when they sent in British tanks to knock down the jail to rescue the agent provocateurs who were killing Iraqis. Why would you do that? Well, if you don't have the strife, how can you justify staying? And when you understand that, you begin to get an idea of really the evil that we're aligned against here. Working at the highest levels of the British government, of American government, because behind everything are powerful secret societies that have an entirely different worldview. If you doubt that we brought Fidel Castro to power, you need to get my talk on World Revolution. That's World Revolution. And there you'll actually see the interview I did back in about 1980 with Ambassador Earl T. Smith, the American ambassador to Cuba. At the time, the United States government brought Fidel Castro to power. And, of course, if you doubt that David Rockefeller's daughter, in fact, both of his daughters were very close to Fidel Castro, why, you need to get the book we carry written by David Rockefeller and called Memoirs. And it is there on page 405 that he admits he's part of a cabal that is conspiring to bring about a new world, a new international order. A new international economic order. And he says, if that's the charge, that I'm part of a cabal that is conspiring to bring about a new international economic order, I stand guilty. I plead guilty. I am a proud internationalist. Well, you can't be an internationalist and be an American, because an internationalist would destroy America's constitutional system of government. But you see, David Rockefeller and the men he represents working within the elite are above country. They have a different allegiance because they worship a different God. You need to get our information on the Earth Charter. You need to get our sustainable development syllabus and my talk on sustainable development. And, of course, understand what the Earth Charter is, the Mein Kampf for the New World Order and the New World Religion and the destruction of the sovereignty of America. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and for our protection. Again, our number 1-800-544-8927.